From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1988 when a group called NWA released their groundbreaking album called Straight Outta Compton. One of the tracks on the album captured the frustration they felt with law enforcement, and let me euphemize the name of that song, F the Police. The album was one of the first to ever earn the warning sticker that read, "These songs contain explicit lyrics, parental guidance suggested." And at performances, NWA was warned by police in some circumstances not to play that song. They often did so anyway. They became heroes to their fans. 2 years after Straight Outta Compton, rapper Ice-T's metal band released a song called Cop Killer. It was condemned by Congress and the FBI, but it certainly made Ice-T a lot of money. And one of the hottest movies of this summer is a biopic that tells the story of NWA called Straight Outta Compton. Produced by Dre and Ice Cube, they say it's an honest look at the struggles they went through on their way to fame. And so this hour we ask, what is the legacy of NWA? The surviving members say that around the country, the conversations about police behavior are parallels to what they rapped about in the late 1980s. Their critics point to alleged misogyny. It's a complex picture, and here to discuss it with us this hour, let me introduce our panel. Natasha Chen Christensen's here. She's the chair of anthropology, history, political science, and sociology at Monroe Community College. And Natasha, it's nice to have you.
Thank you.
William Cleeton Gandino's here. He's a college student and a rapper on the side. And Will, it's nice to have you in studio.
Thank you for having me.
Marquette Lloyd is here. He's a Rochester native, and he's involved in a lot of social conversations in our community. It's nice to have you in studio, Marquette.
Thank you.
Jason Peck is here, modern languages and cultures professor at the University of Rochester and kind of an amateur hip-hop historian. And Jason, it's nice to have you.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, there's no easy way to ask the question, what is the legacy of NWA? I mean, it's much more complex than a single sentence, but Natasha Chen Christensen, let me ask you this then. Where does that answer start? What is the legacy of NWA?
I think that the legacy actually starts with their music. I think that the movie made an interesting portrayal, and, you know, they were very selective in how they portrayed their story. But it really does sort of in awakening the consciousness of people who were living in the suburbs, it was kind of the first time that national attention was placed on the issue of police violence, et cetera.
Okay, so when they say, look, those conversations we've seen in the last 24 months in this country on these subjects are not new to them, and they were the ones who really raised it in a public way for the first time, you think they're taking credit that they deserve?
I do believe that it kind of emerged in the national, you know, in the national consciousness in the late 80s because of that song. I think people who never listened to hip hop, who had never heard anything about the community, were suddenly exposed and asking, why are they so mad at the police, right? Mm-hmm. I know for myself, I was raised in the suburbs, had a very diverse background, in terms of cultures and race, but not class necessarily. And it did make me think, why are they so mad?
Yeah. William Clayton Gandino, what do you think, where do you think that answer starts with the legacy of NWA?
I would have to agree with Natasha. They were the first ones to really bring national attention to issues that, like, white America had never looked at.
Okay. Marquette, what about you?
Well, with their ideas about, you know, going against the police and, you know, not just blindly obeying them. I agree that it shaped the way a lot of us think, where I'm from, at least, you know, as far as just blindly obeying authority and standing up for shakedowns and all that stuff.
How much do you remember growing up and hearing, you know, NWA, you know?
Oh, well, my mom was an avid fan, so I heard
your
them
mom
often.
Was an avid fan?
Yeah, surprisingly. She's an avid fan, so I heard them often. I even remember an incident where we got pulled over, and my sister's 2 years old, and she looks the cop in the face and just says, F the police, right to the cop. And even he kind of smiled a little bit, like even the baby's doing it.
Wow. Wow. Jason Peck, where do you think the answer starts?
I would agree with most of the panel. I think it's a little bit more complicated, and one of the things that I find fascinating about NWA is, you know, in 1988, it's a really pivotal year for hip-hop, and the two albums that I think sort of complement one another are Public Enemies, It Takes a Nation of Million to Hold Us Back, and Straight Outta Compton. And if you look at where both of those groups are today, Public Enemy sort of toils in obscurity. I mean, they have a very strong reputation among sort of the hip-hop fans, but they don't have much success in terms of album sales or tours. Whereas if you look at the legacy of NWA, for whatever reason, and I hope that we get to address this in this hour, they've been able to kind of market themselves and use the system in such a way that any sort of discussion of police brutality, any sort of discussion of a kind of white hegemony sort of always refers back to Straight Outta Compton and to F the Police, whereas other groups that came around at the same time that were maybe saying the very same message and maybe more forcefully or more thoughtfully are sort of forgotten. And I'm curious as to why that is. That's one of my central questions and interests.
Okay, well, then let's move the conversation on the question of police community relations. And obviously it's a big part of the movie. If you've seen the film Straight Outta Compton, and it was a big part of their music, you know, if you haven't heard the song, we're going to play a clip in a second, and it is a bit more of a sanitized version. But before I do that, I want to go ahead and read just a couple sections of lyrics. Here's one: I'm a sniper with a hell of a scope, taking out a cop or two, they can't cope. And a sucker in a uniform waiting to get shot is how the song describes police in some circumstances, white police officers. So, you know, in some sense, you've got NWA saying, we are reflecting the frustration that is boiling up in our communities. And then you had the people who didn't grow up in those communities saying, well, you are turning this into a war with police, and that's wrong, and that you're perpetuating this, you're making it worse. So let's listen to a bit, and then we'll get our panel's take and sort of where they fall in this complex question. This is a sanitized version, if you haven't heard it, part of it, of F the Police. Police coming straight from the underground. A young got it bad because I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. That because I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. And thrown in jail, we can go toe-to-toe in the middle of a sale. I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager, searching my car, looking for the product, thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. All right, that's from F the Police. Let's go back around the table. And Jason Peck, you know, some people will read those lyrics and hear that, and they'll say, you're not reflecting the difficulties you had. You are encouraging people to be violent with police officers. And what do you make of it now?
I think it's a really complicated question. I mean, there's a long tradition, a long sort of politically engaged and intellectual as well tradition around the area that that NWA comes from, that are looking at issues surrounding racism, surrounding the sort of white hegemony and the culture that sort of springs up in response to what they see as institutional racism. And that's definitely sort of reflected in the lyrics. At the same time, we do have to acknowledge that there is a kind of, especially for those of us who didn't grow up in that community, who maybe don't know that sort of systemic violence, there's a way in which that was marketed and kind of packaged to white suburbia in a very kind of titillating way that I think for me, and again, I would love to be challenged on all of this, doesn't speak to the long tradition of sort of thinking through radical politics and thinking through the sort of institutional violence and racism that existed not only in that particular area of Los Angeles, but in the country in general. And so that's what I think.
Okay. Marquette, what do you think when you hear that song now? What do you think?
Well, it definitely reflects the issues that are going on now. And I feel like he was just expressing himself, how irate he was at the situation. It wasn't so much he's telling everyone to go and attack the police and oppose them in so many words, but more of how he felt about it and how we should feel about it.
Okay, and so, again, I go back to, you know, you're growing up in Rochester. People are hearing that. You mentioned your younger sister, right? That moment where she said that to a police officer. You know, and do you think what it did was reflect what people were doing? or spark more of it? You know,
did it reflect what people were doing at the time?
Yeah,
as far
we're,
as
we're,
interaction
we're,
with
we're
the police?
Feeling because you said that, hey, that's how he was feeling. I think that's Ice Cube we heard off the top, right?
That's how many of us were feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, if you live in the hood and you see police going on blocks and just guys congregating and they're just shaking them down, you know, taking their stuff, you don't know. When I was a kid, I didn't realize that they were doing something wrong. To me, that was a norm. You know, they're standing out there hanging out, drinking their beer, smoking their smoke, and the police come along and start causing trouble. I saw it as trouble. That's how I perceived the lyrics, that the police were kind of the bad guy, because these guys, to me, were the good guys.
Okay. Will, when you hear that song now, how much, you know, as an aspiring rapper yourself, how much is that still impacting the music scene?
I don't know how much it's impacting the music scene as a whole, but for me, when I first heard that song especially, it was very powerful that somebody said it, because a lot of people had interactions with the police like that. A lot of people were going through very pressing issues with police-community relations, and somebody finally stood up and said F the police and went, you know, for a full song all about it. And as far as how that, like the artists themselves, what they're doing, because they, you know, talking about killing a cop, Tupac said he had many songs. I'm a very avid Tupac fan. He had many songs about F the police, not named at the police, but about that issue. And he said that when he goes in the booth, he can say, I can't wait to shoot a cop, or, you know, something similar to that, because that's his outlet where he can do that. Like when he got harassed by cops, when he got like beaten up for jaywalking and they smashed his face in on the ground just for jaywalking, he couldn't, you know, hit back, because in the actual moment he couldn't hit back without risking his own life, right? But when he goes in the booth, he can actually use these words to express the feelings and the rage that is inside of him, and create a song that the community can relate to that rage, you know, as a whole.
So did people who did not grow up in that community, who received that music, and again, I think Jason makes an interesting point, the one that I hadn't thought of very much, as somebody who grew up in that set of people in the suburbs, you know, middle class, largely white, and maybe not even realizing that some of the marketing was directed in a titillating way toward that class of people. But for the people who received that music in a way that said, hey, that's wrong, that's threatening, were they taking it too literally, do you think, Will?
Well, possibly. But at the same time, like, we have to understand that people are being pushed to a place where they think it's necessary to shoot a cop. Like, that doesn't just happen overnight. Like, it doesn't just, like, somebody got, like, beat up, so they're like, all right, let's kill cops. Like, that happens from years and years and decades of oppression and of just, you know, beating on them to get to the point where they're like, all right, enough is enough. So we have to look at why they made that song. You know, why did NWA and get to the point where F the Police was like, and you can hear the emotion when Ice Cube raps. And like, that's not false emotion. Like, that's what he really feels. So we have to, like, as a community, look at what got them to that point.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the legacy of NWA, the film Straight Outta Compton, in theaters now, and we're talking about some of these complex issues. Will just mentioned Tupac, who of course has been gone for a while now. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit later this hour about NWA and misogyny. I remember growing up listening to Keep Your Head Up, which is like the least misogyny. It's like anti-misogyny. So there's a lot more out there that, if you don't know sort of the repertoire, might surprise you. But we are going to talk about that. Let me get Natasha Chen Christensen from MCC. Your thoughts on what you hear when you hear F the Police now and you think about the legacy of that song.
I honestly believe that there are still large quantities of Americans who don't understand the anger that motivates that type of sentiment. Semester after semester, I have students in my race course, and I have students who grew up primarily in the suburbs, students who grew up primarily in the city. When city students actually relay their experiences with the police, the suburban students are shocked. Like, mouths drop open because they just can't understand that this happens on such a regular daily basis. I actually had one young man tell me once, he's like, Professor, I didn't know that you could be stopped by one police car. I've only been ever stopped by three or four. I think what made this song so compelling, and why, you know, Jason had mentioned that there were other groups that were more political that were not as well received. This came out of a place of anger, out of frustration. I believe the movie presented it as we are looking for social change. We are advocating social change. That was not what they were doing. They were venting anger, and you hear it. It's visceral anger that comes out in the song.
Now, some may argue that they may not have been doing that intentionally, but that was sort of a byproduct of it.
Right.
You're saying the movie made it too overt, too much of an intentional.
The movie made it a little, it made it seem thought out. There are lyrics, I don't think the intention at the time was to start a revolution or to impact social change. I think they were like, this is what's happening to me. I'm angry. I am going to use my art as a form to convey this to the rest of the world. I don't think the rest of the world has caught up quite yet, though.
Well, you know, I've had a couple of comments from listeners online this morning. And by the way, I would love to hear from our audience. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free. You can call 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you want to react or weigh in on the legacy of this group as we talk about, you know, what kind of the discussion of the different issues that we're seeing in the film and, frankly, the music still today, 27 years after Straight Outta Compton. But I had a number of people this morning say, you can't play that song. You can't play that song on the week of the anniversary of the killing of a Rochester police officer. You can't do it. And I just want to say I understand that sentiment. I understand why that is so raw for people. I mean, Thursday is the anniversary of Daryl Pearson's death. And but Natasha Chen Christensen, as you say, there are people who just don't understand the experience that led to the album. Is that part of the message here that... Yeah, I don't think anybody, nobody's celebrating the death of a Rochester police officer, but I think what you're saying is there is a big divide in understanding.
There's a huge divide in understanding. I can just say for myself, I am a Asian American female in her 40s, part of the like least dangerous class of people perceived in the United States. And since I have moved to Rochester, so like the last 10 years, I've been stopped by the police once. Very polite, ma'amed, et cetera, et cetera. My very close friend has a 22-year-old black son. In the time that he's been driving, so it's been about 4 years that he's been driving, he's been pulled over 28 times. Not been issued a ticket or a warning, just pulled over. And I don't think that much of America realizes exactly what is causing this antagonism.
Well, let me read a few comments, and we'll get to the phones in a second. Here's a listener says, we should feel contempt toward police. Wait till your panel needs them, then we'll see how they feel. You know, Marquette, how do you respond to that? You were talking about what you felt growing up.
Well, I personally don't feel any contempt towards police. But I've been in situations where police prejudge me upon meeting me by the way I look, how I dress, color of my skin, condition of my hair. And then once I start talking to them, they'll say something like, well, wow, I wish I never pulled you over or stopped you because you seem like an all right guy. And that always interests me. It must be something in the way I talk or how I carry myself that changes their opinion that they had before they stopped me. Because when they stop me, there's a guy in your car wearing a hat, so I'm pulling you over. And I'm dead serious. A cop actually said that as a reason. The guy in your car was wearing a hat, so I stopped you. And...
What did you say?
What did I say in response to that? Nothing. Like, why? I'm not going to argue that. Like, well, okay, here's my license registration. You know, do what you have to do. I'm not trying to make trouble. And most people, I think, don't. And some people, maybe they get an attitude or maybe the cop finds what he was looking for. I don't know. But with me personally, I don't cause trouble. And I get pulled over by the police just like anyone else where I'm from would. Like you said, multiple cars. They all come at once. And then once they start talking to me, they change their opinion. And I find that interesting, that if it was someone else who maybe didn't have as much formal education as I did or didn't speak as well as I did, would they be in the same situation as me?
Can I say something?
Yeah, go ahead, Jason.
One of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand or misunderstand has to do with the fact that there's a distinction made between, you know, what I think a song like F the Police is coming out of, which is institutional racism and systemic racism, and then individual interactions with police officer X. And I think what, from the perspective often of sort of white people, it's this idea of, well, you know, the sort of police officer X who stops you or is part of your community can also help you. And I think from the perspective of a lot of people who are in minority communities, it's not the individual police officer. It's the idea that why is it that in my particular community, I get pulled over so many times. I mean, there was this policy of what's known as broken windows policing. And the philosophy behind that policy was if a community has broken windows in a metaphoric sense and in a literal sense, then violent crime will arise from that. It's the same sort of philosophy that came, that sort of exists behind the stop and frisk policies of the Bloomberg era in Manhattan.
So, we saw that most prominently in New York City.
Correct, yes. So I think what ends up happening is if you look at it from a systemic level, of course people get angry because people are prejudging individuals who live in particular communities. If you look at it on a case-by-case basis, of course you can find individual police officers who are kind, decent people who want to protect and serve the communities that they're working in. But that's a sort of miscommunication or misidentification that a lot of people on both sides of this racial divide don't see, or that I should say white people don't see in minority communities.
Yeah, and here's a comment from Mike online, and I think reflecting again some of the divide we've been talking about. He says, doesn't it go both ways? Aren't the police allowed to have a breaking point?
If the police breaking point is merely seeing someone in a car, then no. I think the misunderstanding that's here from the comments that are being directed at the panel is this understanding that there is this reciprocal relationship between the people being stopped and the cops who are stopping them. I have seen friends of mine, I have seen people, educated, middle class, suburban people, get stopped by the police and they feel free to vent their anger, to argue with the police, to just go crazy. And that's not what happens if you are a black male or a young black female being stopped by the police in the city. You cannot argue back. You cannot get angry. There's this absolute silence that you have to deal with this. The song isn't actually a directive. That's not anything people would say to the police. That's venting their anger because they're silenced when they are having these interactions.
Though apparently people have said it. I mean, Marquette related the story of his sister, and the FBI claims that they heard a lot of that, you know, over the years, especially after Cop Killer came out. And I think, I have to imagine, Cop Killer comes out because of the success of F the Police, yes.
I would just also like to point out that we do have a First Amendment, right? Like, you actually can say F the Police without being arrested because you have freedom of speech. Now, whether or not you then move on to other sort of violent means is another question. But I think this idea that somehow there is a taboo for us to even say F the Police is kind of ridiculous in a society that has free speech.
Yeah, you can say it, and you can eventually sell a label to Apple for $3 billion, as Dre did. Let's get Dan in Brighton as first up. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi. I wanted to comment on that. I think the program started kind of talk about the song and what was behind the song and how easy it is to wonder if those same sentiments are what people are feeling today, to compare and contrast the past with the present. Also, I wonder if some people hearing this are going to misconstrue the idea that it's important to hear a person's voice about how they feel about something with really wanting to go cause harm to somebody or advocating for that. I think it's important to differentiate between music and a real commentary or a political directive to do something. So that's what I wanted to have the panel clarify or comment on.
Dan, I think it's a great point, and I think we did hear. I think Will was making that point, but Dan, thanks for the phone call. And let's hit that again. I mean, he's asking, is this art and an expression of frustration as opposed to an overt call to action against police officers? And I think there's still people who don't agree on this, which is why it's so hot. But Will, can you want to make that sound the same point again? I think it's a good question.
Yes, the point that I made earlier was just the fact that when, kind of like Natasha said, when people are stopped by the police, specifically black males, they don't have the opportunity to freely say F the police without having repercussions. And when they're writing a song, they can vent out all of the anger that is pent up from the countless times or however many times they've been stopped by police and harassed. And they can put it all on paper and write it all down and then put it on the radio and upset America, right? And it did. The conversation that we're having right now has been had numerous times in the 90s. It was all over, like people were fighting to get the album taken off the shelves because of F the Police. So this is not a new conversation. And the relation between the music as well and the action is a lot of what they were talking about, because they didn't want their white children to hear these messages and take action on it. They weren't mad when it was in the community. They were mad when it became a part of the white communities in middle America. That's when the conversation came up.
Well, and I actually think the people who make up and made up NWA are very savvy, smart people. And so I take Will's point. I'm trying to envision our audience who might be uncomfortable with the music, might be thinking, okay, if you're Dre, if you're Easy, if you're Cube, you get it. This is an expression of the rage that you felt. But if you're somebody sitting in Rochester, New York, and you feel like you don't have a whole lot of hope, and you're hearing Cube say, I'm a sniper with a hell of a scope, taking out a cop or two, they can't cope. Can you differentiate that is art representing frustration, that is not a call to action? Is that even a fair question?
Absolutely. I do think it's always a fair question.
Aside, I'm asking a question that I think people would have.
But I think that it's dangerous if somehow we begin to think that those of us who may not have the same level of education as others or come from a particular kind of community cannot differentiate between art and action. I mean, I think the whole reason why hip hop is as important as it is because it was a very strong and forceful indication that art could actually come from the crack in the concrete, as Tupac would say. So this idea that, you know, I mean, this is one of my big problems with the way a lot of mainstream media portrays hip hop, is that this idea is there is no distinction between the MC, the persona, and who that person might be in quote unquote real life. That somehow if you are Ice Cube and you use violent language, you must be a thug. You must be someone who then walks around with an Uzi, when I think that that's quite, quite different.
Let me pull in another voice to the conversation. On the phone with us is Gregory Brandon, and he goes by DJ G-Nice. And Greg, are you there?
Yes, I am, Evan. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for taking the time, Greg. I know it's a busy day for you, but I also know, just talking to people this weekend, that you are a pretty important person in the local scene. So tell us a little bit about what you do first.
Actually, I've been a professional DJ here in the city of Rochester in upstate New York for approximately 35 years. I do a lot of production, and I'm closely related to the majority of the going-ons in the hip-hop community as far as with artists and artist development and on the production side of things as well. And I just have an undying, unmitigated love for hip-hop music. I am what you would call a prodigy and child of hip-hop. I was born before the coining of the term hip-hop and grew up throughout the years in the era of the term being coined and used to relate to a style and genre of music, which pretty much was birthed in the urban areas. But actually, rap, as it is so called, you know, predates the date that hip-hop was evolved.
All right, well, I know you've heard part of the conversation. I just want to get your take as well on this before we turn to other aspects of NWA and their legacy. We've been talking about their song, we've been euphemistically saying F the Police, and the way it reflected their frustration in their own community and certainly communities across the country. How do you view the legacy of that particular song and maybe the way it's still thought of today, Greg?
Well, I remember vividly when the song was released and we were first here in Rochester able to get a copy and physically hear it for ourselves. I remember it so vivid that morning. We had just left the studio doing some recordings, and we were all gathered early that morning at a local playground, and we listened to the song, and literally our mouths dropped when we heard it, but an instant energy that we could like instantly relate to, like here is a cry and an opportunity to voice an opinion of discontent with a situation in our communities. But it was a little frightening initially because of the brash harshness in the reality of what they were actually saying after police. And we looked at each other like, we don't know what this is going to culminate into, but we could totally understand the discontentment and the disheartening feeling of what youth in disenfranchised areas in our community were feeling and going through at the time.
Greg, we had some listeners this morning send me notes saying, you know, did this band, did NWA, did they glamorize that kind of life? As much as they struggled, did they glamorize it and make it cool and make it something to aspire to, as opposed to saying, this is something that we can overcome? And you know, I don't have an answer for that, but what do you think, Greg?
Well, that's a darned if you do, darned if you don't type of question, because with the event of NWA saying this, you have to realize that for every one person that has an opportunity to publicly voice their opinion, there are probably hundreds, thousands, if not millions of others that feel that same type of feeling, but whether it's because of how we were raised or, you know, community standards or whatever, nobody was really wanting to cry out. As far as the glamorization of what they were saying, I don't think they had the inherent intent on glamorizing it. Now, when you get into the perspective of what labels and other entities who control the releasing of said material, then it becomes a little bit gray area, because at the end of the day, it is a business. And in business, it's about profitability and things of that nature. Now, as far as Jerry Heller goes, I'm not sure if he sat somewhere with a diabolical mindset saying, here's an opportunity to take a relatively like strong statement as far as F the police and take it and turn it into a situation for monetary gain or glamorization. Only he would know that.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. And Greg, before we let you go here, just one more quick question for you, which is, you know, many of our audience might not be very familiar with the local hip hop scene now. And I want you to just kind of paint a little picture for us about what is going on in Rochester now. And then what are some of the social issues that you are hearing about now that matter to people who are on the scene now?
Well, first and foremost, the hip hop scene is something that's ever evolving and ever going through changes. And like I said, once again, when I started with doing music, and especially in the genre of hip hop, it wasn't about money, because nobody was getting $100 million contract deals and nobody was making, you know, boatloads of money back then. We did it as strictly an art form and a form of expression. I grew up understanding the principalities of rapping, which is a part of the hip-hop culture, which that's a whole other story within itself, is the definitions between hip-hop and rap and how they're confused and misconstrued. But rap was sort of a tool for me to be from another side of town and take stories that were relative to me and be able to put them into a form that was not only artful and entertaining, but to be able to give a message and tell of what was going on in my situation or my time in my area. Now it's really just about profit and dollars and cents. So the art form is taking a serious bashing, and it's just not the same that it used to be.
Greg is Gregory Brandon, and you go by DJ G-Nice. Is that right, Greg?
Yes, that's a name that I've carried for a long time, is G-Nice, and that's how all of my friends, family, and associates, they're an endearing name, if you will, that I go by.
Well, like I said, I know it's a busy day for you. Thanks for calling the program, sharing your perspective, and I hope we'll catch up again on this and other subjects.
Absolutely. I'll be listening in, and probably will call back in for a couple more points to give and speak in, relative to the conversation, because this is something very important that is going on. And right now, in the communities across America and across the country, it's not just a black thing, it's an everybody thing. And the country is in turmoil. There is violence and chaos, and I fear for the future of the children of America with the state of society and what's going on in it currently.
Well, Greg, I'll tell you this. I know we talked this morning. I know you're kind of up against it for a couple of things today, but if you can hang there on the phone with us, what we'll do is we'll take a break. Can you stay there, and we'll finish the hour with our panel here, Greg, on the phone?
I'm actually in a stable position right now, all right. And I'm all ears, and I'm all yours.
All right, so let's do that. So we've got Greg Brandon on the line, DJ G Nice, more than 3 decades of experience in the local hip-hop scene, Jason Peck's here, modern language and cultures professor at the University of Rochester and an amateur hip-hop historian, Marquette Lloyd is here, a Rochester native who's involved in a number of different social issues locally. William Cleeton Gandino is a college student and kind of an aspiring rapper, an amateur rapper himself. And Natasha Chen Christensen is a chair of anthropology, history, political science, and sociology at MCC. Short break, and we turn the question toward whether misogyny is a fair charge with NWA. That's next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, you might have seen the banners hung by a fraternity on freshman drop-off day at Old Dominion University. The banners kind of taunted parents who are dropping off freshman girls. Hope your daughter's ready for a good time. Freshman daughter drop-off here, pointing to the front door of the frat. Is it an example of rape culture, or do we all need a better sense of humor? It's debated next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from East House, presenting the 7th Annual Hope and Recovery Luncheon featuring former NFL player and mental health advocate Herschel Walker, Tuesday, September 29th at the Riverside Convention Center. For more information, visit easthouse.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. One of the hottest films of the summer is Straight Outta Compton, the story produced by Dre and Ice Cube, telling the story of NWA and their rise to fame in the late 80s and early 90s, and everything they went through as a group, their breakup, and some of the other issues involved. And we're talking about the legacy of NWA this hour. We've been talking about their song, their big hit song, F the Police, but also the question of police-community relations. I also want to talk about another issue that a lot of critics have focused on, and that is alleged misogyny in the group. And in a minute, we're going to kind of go around and hear the panel's thoughts, but I want to read exactly what Ice Cube said about this. He was asked by Rolling Stone magazine about the lyrics of NWA, their treatment of women, and whether it's fair to say that they were misogynists. And I'm just going to quote here, and some of the language is a little coarse, but I'm going to quote from Ice Cube in Rolling Stone magazine. Quote, "If you're a bitch, you're probably not going to like us. If you're a hoe, you probably don't like us. If you're not a hoe or a bitch, don't be jumping to the defense of these despicable females. Just like I shouldn't be jumping to the defense of no punks or no cowards or no slimy SOBs that are men. I never understood why an upstanding lady would even think we are talking about her." End quote. That's Ice Cube. Natasha Chen Christensen, the only woman on the panel today. Let me start with you.
Yeah.
Is he right?
No. I'm an upstanding woman who fully realizes that he is talking about all women when he uses that terminology. And Cube, don't want to mess with angry women. It's long been a theory from black feminist culture, black feminist perspective, that because black men, Latino men, have been denied ways to claim masculinity in American society through, you know, financial gain, through capitalism, through money, that they in turn kind of wield their power over those that they can. A lot of this then becomes articulated into physical power and oppression of women, oppression of the LGBT community, etc. I find it interesting that there are just now claims of misogyny from NWA, since most of their music, I would say all of their music, is misogynist. And that was sanitized to such a high degree in the movie that I was a little bit shocked about how they were kind of held up as these social activist role models, right? And very little was mentioned about their treatment of women, of the women that were portrayed in the movie. I think besides the two moms, everyone else was a prop. Pretty much.
Well, here's what Dr. Dre says about his own past, because since the film came out, there's been a lot of sort of a refocusing of attention on the allegations that that he has been abusive towards women, a 1991 incident in which he assaulted a TV host named Dee Barnes, as well as recent charges of physical abuse by his 1990s girlfriend named Michelle. In 1992, by the way, Dre did plead guilty to charges about assaulting TV host Dee Barnes, and he was unapologetic. He said, quote, "It ain't no big thing. I just threw her through a door," end quote. Well, here's what he says now, telling Rolling Stone magazine, quote, "I made some horrible mistakes in my life. I was young, stupid. I would say all the allegations aren't true. Some of them are. Those are some of the things that I would like to take back, but I paid for those mistakes, and there's no way in hell that I will ever make another mistake like that again." Natasha?
That was half of an apology. That wasn't a sincere apology.
You want more?
If he was the executive producer, right? So if he really was contrite, if he really felt bad about his actions, he would have included them in the movie and portrayed himself as something beyond this saint that comes across in the movie.
All right, let me ask William then, because you're on the rap scene now. You know, you're doing some things yourself. You're a college student, but you're also a rapper. How much do you listen to their music and hear something that we would say is misogynistic? And are you aware of that and what you create yourself?
I saw the movie and saw it as very misogynistic. All of the NWA music that I've listened to is pretty misogynistic. At least every time women are mentioned, it's in a misogynistic way. Sometimes women just aren't even mentioned. And I think it's important for us to look at the fact that we were mad about F the Police, but we weren't mad about the misogynistic lyrics. So like in the 90s, America as a whole was outraged over F the Police, but didn't care about the, quote, bitches and hoes.
I think you're right.
To me, and I was also raised by a sociologist, so I could see the misogyny in it very clearly. And to me, I thought the movie was almost as misogynistic as their music, but they also didn't portray the Dre, the what you just mentioned about the events that Dre took part in, that he now says that he regrets, but they didn't even show those in the movie. I think that, and Dre was also he was kind of like the sweet younger guy
who
was very Eazy-E and Ice Cube were the more you could see the violence and they were supposed to be the hard ones, and Dre was very soft or whatever in the movie. That's how I saw it.
I saw it that way too.
And he and Ice Cube were the producers, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think it's important to know that. But the roots of the misogyny, like Natasha was talking about, with the ways the theories in which that Black and Latino men take power in whatever way is possible based on the fact that they've been denied power economically and denied entrance into white society. And the way that Tupac said in relation to that is that over the decades, they're knocking on the door, right? Metaphorically, they're knocking on the door trying to get fed, right? They know there's food on the other side of the door. And they know people are eating, that there's extra food. And they're knocking on the door please let me in, please let me in. And 10 years later, they're come on, I want some food. And then 10 years later, they're like, let us in. And then 10 years later, they're like, all right, we're kicking in the door and we're taking food. So, and the reason I say that is because this is not, we can't just look at 1988 or even between then and now in this situation. We have to look at historically, going back to the 60s, going back before the 60s, to the end of the Civil War even, until now, to get a clear picture at what has created this.
I think that's well said.
If I could just say quick thing about the misogyny, and just to challenge one thing, because I'm old. I remember when the Parents Music Resource Council first sort of came to prominence, headed by Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife. The first thing they actually focused on was not the violence, but rather the misogyny, because it was something that played very well to white liberal female, sort of concerns. So they would come out and say, do you want your daughter to be called a bitch? Do you want your daughter to be called, a whore? And that got a lot of traction. actually. And it wasn't, I think, until slightly later that this question of violence then became sort of the main focus of sort of the white liberal establishment against hip-hop.
Gregory Brandon on the line with us, DJ G-Nice in Rochester. Greg, what to you is what's the legacy as relates to the way NWA talks about women, and are you concerned about sort of a lasting impact on young men who hear those lyrics?
Sadly, the degenerative aspect of misogyny, and even still, the portrayal of the female gender crosses all barrier lines. What makes this situation stand out is because these are iconic figures in the public eye, so they're scrutinized much more. But, I mean, let's take, for instance, the pornographic industry, which I can count on one hand the African-American porn stars as opposed to the big money-making porn stars via white and black. So as far as the exploitation of the female gender, that has been going on since the beginning of time, just as with African-Americans coming from slavery until the time that we are now. So these topics are very relative, but once again, the views and opinions and the way they're expressed across racial lines take curves that are unsavory and unsettling to me. And a lot of the times, people will get judged and put into a situation of judgment without having had a real opinionated opportunity to show why these things happen and occur. Now, in the case of NWA, once again, you have to look at the relative fact that sex sells across the board. That's how it's been. When you look at advertisement today, you don't see a lot of women, any color, that weigh 200 pounds and, you know, don't look a certain ratio of aspect of beauty, if you will, or a certain criteria of looking. So there's always been an air of, like, trying to find some words and not, like, get real.
But is it okay with you? Is it okay with you, Greg?
It's never been okay with me, but it is what society has perpetuated. I mean, I do not prefer to be called the N-word, mm-hmm. just like I'm sure any woman, whether white, black, Latino, Asian, would like to be called the B-word. So it's not all right, and that's not what our titles and our names, that's not what our parents named us as. And it does play a role in, like I said, the aspect of industry and what it perpetuates. Now, if we look at the real scenario, what's going on here, when a record is created by a group who is under the moniker and guise of a label, it has to go through a series of protocols before that record is even brought to the level of being released to the public. So you therefore have to, in turn, look at the powers that be who control that infrastructure to allow these things
to happen. The Jerry Hellers, et cetera. Yes, I take that point. But Natasha, you're shaking your head, and we're going to run out of time. You want to weigh in just briefly here?
Just very briefly. I think you dodged the question by kind of pointing out all of the misogyny in all of American culture. You know, we're still talking about an aspect of this group that I think a lot of people want to excuse away by saying, look, it's embedded. It's embedded, however, you are looking at a reification of this misogyny. You're talking about two executive producers who could have portrayed anything they wanted to in the movie, besides two cameos by their moms, pretty much, actresses playing their moms. Every single female in there was a prop.
Okay, so Greg, since we're going to run out of time, just a short rebuttal. Go ahead, Greg.
The rebuttal to that is, once again, I'm not Easy. I'm not Dr. Dre. I'm neither one of those gentlemen. So I don't know why those things were portrayed as such. But I know that him making a public apology about the misogynistic ways, which were definitely heir apparent in his behavior and in lyrics, didn't have anything to do with the marketing and selling of this movie. they, you know, the powers that be, once again, the infrastructure that allow these things to come to pass, are, you know, it doesn't sell. It's not going to sell tickets, him apologizing about him being a womanizer.
All right, so Greg, hold on. Let me let Marquette, since we're literally on our last 30.
Are you saying that they, like, didn't focus on the misogyny to sell the movie?
Basically, in essence, it's what it's about. The movie, first and foremost, is entertainment. Hinting on the points of them talking about the history, which you can't get in.
Well, I don't feel like NWA is being pigeonholed for misogyny. I don't feel like they're being pigeonholed because they're public figures.
Guys, hold on a second. We're going to run out of time for the hour, and I feel like we just got started. Well, you all, we need to come back and talk about this.
We need a second hour.
This is such a deep and evolving situation.
Well, Cube literally has a manifesto of misogyny on one of the tracks.
Where you take a year talking about this, and we can go back and forth forever. What? But, you know, there are a lot of factors in place why certain things are allowed to happen and perpetuated as opposed to being stopped and looked at.
Ice Cube literally has a manifesto of misogyny on one of the tracks where he talks about how he's not going to let a woman F him out of his money.
All right. See,
in so many ways.
You see what we need to do? The host needs to book another hour. We need to follow this up. Greg, thank you for being on the line,
yes,
and I'm going to get back in touch with you because we're not done with this.
Absolutely.
To the panel, thank you so much. Thank you for being here, all of you guys, and hopefully we'll talk again soon. Short break, more connections next.